Over the next 2 weeks, we are going to be diving into the book of 2 John. It is going to be a two-part series because two parts is pretty much what it takes to cover the whole book. It is especially relevant for us today, I think, in our current cultural climate that we find ourselves in. 2 John was a letter written by the Apostle John to a local church that was going through a particularly painful time of conflict and division. And so in many ways, it's got a lot to say to us today because we find ourselves in a situation very similar. All of us in this room know that conflict is not fun, right? Nobody wakes up in the morning and goes, "I am really looking forward to fighting with my spouse today." I'm so happy that last week I had that big blow up with my parents. Man, that was so much fun. I can't wait to do it again. Nobody thinks that. Nobody feels that way. We all know that personal conflict is not fun. In 2 John, however, we are dealing with a different kind of conflict, a kind that is more difficult to deal with than personal conflict for a number of reasons. It's usually because there are a lot of people involved, and the stakes are high for every single person involved. Everyone involved has a lot to lose. It's usually because some sort of deep-held ideology or some sort of deeply held belief is clashing with another person's ideology or another group's deeply held beliefs. And this kind of turns into an us versus them sort of mentality when it festers and it grows. Lastly, this kind of conflict is a kind of conflict that goes on for a very long time because it can't be solved by a peace offering of a chocolate bar or ice cream. And it can't be solved by taking a time out. This is the kind of conflict that goes on for a while because there are no simple solutions and the reasons for it are complex. The kind of conflict that we are going to be talking about today is community or corporate conflict. And it is a kind of conflict that we are becoming increasingly familiar with in our cultural climate today, in the culture that we find ourselves living in. A couple of weeks ago, I was having a conversation with a friend, and we were kind of talking about our frustrations at all of the back and forth that we were seeing in the news and on social media. And this is before we watched the presidential debate, by the way, so this was even before that. We were so tired of all the things we were seeing, where even minor points of contention, seemingly small things, like using hand sanitizer, became a reason for people to insult each other, or became a reason for people to disrespect each other, became a reason for people to be condescending towards another person. This year has been tiring enough, right? Emotionally, spiritually, mentally, 2020 has been tiring enough without adding conflict into the mix. And yet, here it is, conflict on a large scale among a lot of people. We're seeing people exchange hurtful words in the name of Christ and against the name of Christ. We're seeing people make assumptions about other people because of their background or their opinion on a certain topic. And we're seeing people become more and more polarized, more and more on different ends of a spectrum. And maybe you've dealt with this personally. Maybe you've engaged with someone and you've experienced the kind of back and forth that I'm talking about. Or maybe you find yourself in a position today where you're so afraid of saying the wrong thing or starting something accidentally that you don't know what to say at all. This is the effect of community conflict. If there is an upside to being in this sort of situation in our society at large, I would say that the only upside is that this means that we are in a position to understand 2 John in a way that is more personal and more particular than ever before. We are in a better position to understand this letter because we are familiar with the experiences and the feelings of the people that John is writing to. This church was going through so much division. People were leaving because there were false teachers that were teaching the wrong things about Jesus and leading people to leave the community. And the people that stayed would be left to deal with the fallout of broken relationships, broken fellowship, and they'd be processing all the feelings of grief, of loss, of anger, and of hurt at the same time as trying to walk faithfully through all of this mess. Now, the Bible never presupposes that we are not going to walk through conflict. The Bible never assumes that because we become a Christian or because we're a part of a church, that we are never going to experience conflict again. That's just not possible. So what John gives us is not a solution to end all conflict. It's not a guide, a 10-step process to wrapping up conflict once and for all. Instead, what he gives us is principles and truth that is meant to guide us as we walk through conflict. He gives us truths so that we can be faithful people and still honor God while we walk through conflict. And what we see in the first six verses of 2 John is something very, very deceivingly simple. And that can be boiled down to the fact that faithful people love people faithfully. Simple, but actually a lot harder to put into practice than you think. Let's read from the first three verses of 2 John. "The elder to the elect lady and her children, whom I love in truth, and not only I, but also all who know the truth. Because of the truth that abides in us and will be with us forever, grace, mercy, and peace will be with us from God the Father and from Jesus Christ, the Father's Son, in truth and love." Now, this is a letter, again, written by John. So the elder in this letter opening is John. And you might be wondering who this elect lady is. Who is this woman that John is referring to? Well, actually, the elect lady and her children is a personification or a metaphor for the entire church. It's meant to refer to the church as a whole. And this is not unusual in the Bible, actually. In other places in the Bible, the church is referred to as the bride of Christ, and so on and so forth. And so actually, it's not unusual for the church to be referred to this way. But what's significant about this for our purposes today is the fact that we are pointed back in a way to the nature, the essential nature and character of the church. What I mean by that is that this is a reminder, I think, that before the church is institutional, before the church is organizational, and before the church is programmatic, the church is personal. The church is made up of real people with real experiences and very real feelings and very real opinions, which don't always mesh. The church is personal. It is made up of real persons. And the intention for all of us as persons in the church is for us to live in peace. Now, when I say peace, I do not mean peace as in the absence of conflict. That's not what I'm saying. The word peace in verse 3 is more literally translated as shalom. Shalom is a major concept in the Bible, and it refers to much more than just not fighting. It refers to a total state of well-being, a total state of being, living in harmony with God and with the people around you. It refers to your relationships with God vertically and horizontally with other people. It refers to all of that. And so it's much bigger than just this idea that we're not fighting when we're in shalom. Now, these two are connected on purpose because it already emphasizes the idea that if we love God, we are called to love the very real people that are made in his image. The two things cannot be separated. We cannot say that we love God and not love the very real people that he's placed in the church with us. We can't love the idea of church. We can't love the idea of Christianity. We have to love the very real people that God places next to us. Church is personal. And this is important, because we have this tendency as human beings to generalize and to villainize. We paint people with a really broad brush, don't we? The best example of this is a couple years ago when a late night show came out with a segment called Celebrities Reading Mean Tweets. Do you remember this? You might not. But there was this segment where celebrities, sports stars, actors, all these people would read some of the mean comments that people had written to them over Twitter. And sometimes, if it was dumb enough, it was funny. But sometimes, when they were reading these things, you just got the sense that it was unnecessarily cruel, and that any person would never in a million years say this to somebody to their face. You just got that sense, that there was a sense of empowerment because they were behind a screen. And what I'm saying today is that when we paint people with a broad brush, when we use labels like snowflakes or communist lovers, which I've heard, when you use labels like that, when you use labels like idiots or this or that or whatever, when you use labels like that, you're actually dehumanizing people. You're disrespecting the image of God that is in them because you're not recognizing them as a real person. You're lumping them in as part of this faceless entity, and it feels like it gives you permission to say things about them that you would never say to a real person. That's the reality. Love refuses to dehumanize. It refuses to dishonor the image of God in someone else, and it refuses to slander people. It refuses to do any of that, regardless of how much you think the other person deserves it. And I would say this, that the way we talk to others and the way we talk about others says more about our hearts than it does about the other person. Part of loving real people, the other part of loving real people, I should say, is being gracious. Being gracious. Real people are affected by the very real circumstances that they find themselves in. And the collective anxiety, fear, anger, grief, and loss that everyone around us has experienced over the last 6 months has taken a toll on us, ourselves included. All of the things that have been going on inevitably affect what's going on with the other person and what's going on with you. And what's that old saying? Hurt people, right? And so to a certain extent, we have to understand that even though someone's behavior isn't right, that to a certain extent, there's a hurt that's behind that that we need to be cognizant of, we need to be aware of. And we need to show grace for that. We need to show grace for the people that are hurting so much that they feel the need to hurt other people. And we need to remember that even if somebody speaks to us or responds to us in a way that is hurtful, we are not responsible for how they talk to us. We are not held responsible for how they respond to us, but we are responsible for the way we respond to them. We are responsible for what we say to them and how we act towards them. That responsibility does not go away just because the circumstances are not so good. And that's exactly what we see in the next few verses, in the next three verses. Let's read on in verse 4. I rejoiced greatly to find some of your children walking in the truth, just as we were commanded by the Father. And now I ask you, dear lady, not as though I were writing you a new commandment, but the one we have had from the beginning, that we love one another. And this is love, that we walk according to his commandments. This is the commandment, just as you have heard from the beginning, so that you should walk in it. Now, I said faithful people love people faithfully. And I'm using faithfully in a couple different senses of the word today. Loving people faithfully means loving people consistently. When John writes, he commends the people that have continued to walk in the truth, who have continued to walk according to the commandments, even though there are people around them that are hurting them and attacking them. They've continued doing it despite the circumstances. And what this tells us is that circumstances are never an excuse for bad behavior. Circumstances are never an excuse for us to do whatever we feel like doing or say whatever we feel like saying. Cruelty and unkindness are never justified, no matter how much you think the other person deserves it. Cruelty and injustice and unkindness are just never justified, because our call is to love people, full stop. That's it. We're called to love people. We're called to not stop loving people just because of the circumstances that we find ourselves in. It doesn't change just because it's a little harder to do. The call is the same. And don't hear what I'm not saying. I'm not saying that we have to go along to get along, because love, Christ-like love, rejects this idea that harmony has to come at the cost of truth. Peacekeeping is not the same as peacemaking. That's important for us to remember. Peacekeeping is not the same as peacemaking. And when we think that harmony has to come at the cost of truth, then we're actually peacekeeping, we're not peacemaking. We tend to downplay the truth because the truth is uncomfortable or because the truth is inconvenient. And I'll give you an example from my own life. This past week, my husband Christian and I were talking about our grocery budget, basically. We talked about the money that we had left in groceries, because he had gone out to go get some groceries, and I said, well, the rest of our grocery budget was kind of taken up already, but it's okay, because I'll move some stuff around, and we'll make it work. It's not a big deal. And so Christian, of course, comes back to me, and he says, oh, well, I thought that we had this much money left. What happened to it? And I said, I don't know. Maybe you spent it. Well, of course. He's like, well, I didn't spend it. Did you spend it? And I said, I don't think so. And honestly, we went back and forth on this until finally Christian says, okay, well, this is pretty simple. Why don't we just pull out the budget app that we use, check the last few entries, and we can see where it went. And I went, okay, sure, yeah, that's a great way to show I'm right. and then I pulled out the app, and I looked at it. I'm not proud of this, but I said, you know what? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Let's move on. Because in that moment, the truth was inconvenient for me. It was inconvenient for the narrative that I was telling him and the narrative that I had told myself. But here's the thing. Real love is not blind. Real love does not turn a blind eye to the truth. And it does not turn a blind eye to sin. Real love confronts sin. Real love is not afraid to confront sin in people, in systems, in institutions, and even in governments. It's not afraid to do all of these things, because love always acts in the best interest of the people around them. And enabling sin, or allowing sin to continue, or ignoring sin is not in the best interest of any person. It's not in the best interest of anyone. Love is faithful to the truth, because love is rooted in and faithful to the Jesus who is the way, the truth, and the life. And when we look at Jesus, we see that truth and love go hand in hand. Jesus was never afraid to confront sin to the point where he was willing to flip tables to confront sin. But he never did so in a way that dehumanized people or disrespected them or was condescending to them. He never did so in a way that disrespected the image of God in the person that he was facing. And he always acted in the best interest of the person and the people that he was ministering to the point where he was willing to sacrifice his own interests in order to serve the interests of the people that he loved. And this is what we remember when we take communion. The character of the Jesus who held truth and love together and didn't see them as mutually exclusive. As we take communion together in a few minutes, I want us to remember, this is the truth that we remember with communion, that there is no gap between us that is so big that the blood and body of Christ cannot overcome it. And I hear a couple of you already pulling out your communion wafers and pulling back the film. And I want us to just take a minute and, if you have done that already or if you haven't, to just take a moment and look at the cup and the bread, if you can call this bread. Take a moment and look at it. If you were here with us before this whole COVID thing started, you know that this is not how we have taken communion in the past, right? You know this. You know that this is not what communion looked like for us pre-COVID. But the truth that this represents, the blood and the body of Jesus, the gospel truth that we proclaim, the gospel truth that we remember, the truth has not changed. It has not shifted one inch. It's just the expression, the method, the way that we do this has changed. As we take the communion elements together, I think it's important for us to remember this. The command to love God and love others as ourselves has not changed. That has not shifted one inch. But the way that we do that, the way that we express that love, the way that we live out this commandment might need to adopt a new method and new ways. We might need to adjust our way of living and our way of living out this commandment in order to adapt to the new circumstances that we find ourselves in. And this is not new for us as the church. In fact, the longer you've been a Christian, the more you probably know that this is true. That growing mature in your faith and growing in your faith is not about learning all sorts of new things about Jesus. It's actually about taking old truth and applying it to new circumstances. Old truth, new expressions. That's what this is. And that's what we're called to do when we're called to love people. Old commandment, new expression. So let's think about that. And I want us all to engage with the mind to think about how we might best love people in the circumstances we find ourselves in. How might we love people best? How might we care for them best during this time?